Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Disruptors, an IFT podcast that brings you the latest insights and perspectives from some of the brightest minds in the science of food. Each episode, our guests will discuss the ever-changing intersection of entrepreneurship, innovation, and science, and their role in advancing the global food system. With the rapid spread of COVID-19, the global food system has been pulled into new and uncertain territory. New recommendations for personal and public safety, the global nature of the pandemic, and resulting shifts in consumer behavior have all contributed to this uncertainty. This episode of Food Disruptors is one of several that will explore the immediate and lasting effects that COVID-19 may have on the food industry. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden, and today we're going to speak with experts on food manufacturing and food safety. We'll feature insights about what COVID-19 means for food production and how the industry can ensure food safety in this unique environment. Today, I'm joined by Dr. David Acheson, founder and CEO of the Acheson Group, and Bruce Perkin, the principal scientist and operator of Robust Food Solutions, LLC. Thank you both for being on the podcast today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Pleasure to be with you all today.
So let's just dive right in and talk a little bit about the science behind food safety under COVID-19. How have we seen the science behind food safety in this pandemic evolve, and how have the recommendations and regulations followed suit? David, let's start with you.
Well, Matt, I don't think that the science behind food safety has really changed. The science is what it is, and food safety is built on science. So that really hasn't shifted. I think where we see some of the changes, it really relates to the stresses of what's going on in this COVID-19 outbreak. So as we're getting absenteeism and using of temporary employees and having to train them quickly, make changes in our shift structures and the groups that are working together to try to maintain social distancing, running lines with maximizing social distancing, but recognizing some lines we can't do that. Potentially the use of masks, which are coming more online, and the request to use homemade masks, and how that can create threats and concerns for the food supply. If somebody's bringing in a cloth mask and wanting to wear it, how do we protect the food they're making? So fundamentally, the science hasn't changed. I think the risk profiles have changed as employees are worried and food companies are concerned about making food and making it safely. Because the last thing we need is for us to have a food safety outbreak on top of the COVID-19 pandemic. That would clearly be an even bigger disaster. So I think that, I think the science is fundamentally the same. We just have to apply it in a little different way, and perhaps leverage technology differently and more effectively, along with data analytics as our employee structure gets taken away to some extent or other, and relying on technology to help manage those risks more than we do already. So that's kind of my thoughts on that one, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I think you bring up a lot of really good points that we're going to dive in and do a little bit of exploration on those coming up. Bruce, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on this as well.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Matt. I appreciate that. David's covered off a lot of the really important stuff, and I'll build on that by commenting that what we're seeing in the food industry is roughly 50%, it's not exactly 50%, but roughly half of the food manufacturing industry has seen dramatic increases in their demand and their output, and roughly half has seen fairly significant decreases. And if you overlay on top of that, this pandemic hit us at around the time when, particularly in the food service industry, there was build-up happening for March Madness, for St. Patrick's Day. So the supply chain was straining at the seams and completely full at a time when restaurants and food service had its biggest decline. So from a food safety perspective, that has fairly dramatic impacts. The training of the incremental staff that you need, and how do you recruit incremental staff at a time when we've got social distancing in place and we're not asking people to be out and about at all, to cope with the incremental volume? What do you do with the staff that you feel you can no longer support? And do you then run into a food safety problem because those people will then leave and you won't be able to get them back again when it starts back up again? And what do you do with this food that's in the supply chain? And we are seeing that the FDA and their wisdom is, and quite rightly so, has put guidelines in place to allow food service foods to be resold into retail under certain circumstances. So to help with some of that. But there is certainly some fairly dramatic impact on food safety with what this virus is concerned. Ultimately, though, this is not, as David said, this is not a food-borne disease. It's not food that we need to be managing here. It's people. And people are at the heart of making food, and so it becomes a food-related disease, even though it's not a food-borne disease. So we'll just reiterate, and I think you'll hear David and I say this over and over again, there is no evidence that we can find of any transmission from foods.
And I think that's a really good point that you're making too, in that, you know, a lot of the concern that might, you know, impact food safety is really driven by the fact that food has to be made somehow in a certain environment. And so there's just that stretching that David mentioned, and then Bruce, what you're mentioning in terms of, you know, keeping staff informed and kind of the logistics of maintaining a food safety program can be a little bit more challenging in this type of environment. So I did want to dive a little bit into the fact that, you know, there is, I think, maybe more of a consumer side concern of, you know, catching COVID-19 or the coronavirus through food. And, you know, I think there is some concern about, you know, maintaining social distance in grocery stores and making sure that, you know, someone doesn't cough on their hand and then touch a food package that you then touch. But, you know, the European Food Safety Authority and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration have both noted, like you both said, the lack of evidence for transmission of the virus through foods and packaging. And, you know, maybe a simple question, but is this just due to routine good manufacturing practices, or is this due to more complex, you know, food safety practices that have been put in place under this pandemic?
So this is really about the nature of the virus itself. It's an envelope virus, a lipid bilayer at its core, and that means it's sensitive to heat, desiccation, detergents, and even low pH, you know, pH is below 3, disrupt this virus. So it's relatively easy to disrupt. So in that respect, It doesn't survive very well in under most food environments, and it is a piece of RNA. It's not an organism of itself, and it needs a host in order for it to reproduce and multiply. So, if you then look at the coefficient of transfer that you end up with viruses in particular, and there has been numerous people that have studied the transmission of viruses, and phages usually is a surrogate for it. And what they typically find is on a dry surface, the level of transfer is very, very small. And in fact, the indications that you hear from experts like Dr. Don Schaffner and others would say to you that the level of transfer from a dry surface is less than 1%. So if I've got it on a package, the amount that I get from the package to my hand is less than 1%, and then I've got to transfer that from my hand to a surface that it would cause some infection in my body, some sort of mucous membrane, nose, mouth. And again, that level of transfer is likely to be extremely low. So it's not surprising that we are getting very limited transfer off hard surface like packaging.
David, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. I think, Bruce has made some really good points there about, this is not a particularly tough virus. It dies out on surfaces. It's certainly not going to reproduce and multiply on a surface like we have concerns about other organisms like Listeria and Salmonella that we're all too familiar with. As we've said and want to reiterate, there's no indication that it is spreading through food, either epidemiologically or in any other way. Is there any indication it's spreading through food? Given its physical properties that Bruce has just outlined, it's not surprising. And, there are many infectious agents that we don't see transmitting through food. Influenza doesn't transmit through food. Other coronaviruses don't transmit through food. Measles doesn't transmit through food. So there's plenty of precedent that viruses can be highly virulent and very nasty to the human. They just simply aren't transmitted through food. And this seems to be one of those, which is a good thing. Further support of that is there is some science out there that indicates that this virus is binding to ACE2 receptors, and those receptors are much more common in respiratory epithelium than they are in gut epithelium. So, that's another potential explanation of why it's not transmitting very readily, if at all, through food. And the other factor is that our whole gastrointestinal system is designed to manage unpleasant things, and it starts with saliva and the enzymes in your mouth and in saliva, which have destructive properties and start to break down food, break down anything that you put in your mouth, and that process continues down your esophagus and into your gastrointestinal tract, and obviously stomach is acid, and as Bruce said, this virus is not going to do well in acid, low pH. So I think there's some science to explain why it's not transmitting through food, and we're certainly not seeing it epidemiologically. So I think that we've got plenty to worry about with person-to-person transmission. That's where we should focus our attention. That's where the regulators are focusing their attention, which is entirely right, and public health officials. So we should thank our lucky stars that foodborne transmission is not something we have to worry about with this one. As I say, we've got plenty of work to do to focus on managing the food safety risks that will result in absenteeism and temporary workers and various other factors that we've talked about or will talk about in this conversation.
I think what you both have said really kind of points to the fact that the risk of transmission of this virus through food does not necessarily, it doesn't really represent what we consider right now a true food safety risk necessarily, but where this virus does impact food safety is kind of in, again, what you said, the strain that it might put on a manufacturing environment that has a food safety program in place. So, I want to dive into that and dissect it a little bit. And, I understand the new guidelines on social distancing really must affect the normal operation of manufacturing facilities. And I'm curious to hear what sort of tactics that you've seen some facilities employ and what we've learned from those tactics. So, David, let's start with you.
Well, what food companies are doing is, and they're adopting a number of different tactics. Firstly, to the extent that they can make social distancing work, they're doing that. This can work pretty well in warehouse operations where, there's not so many people. You can socially distance much more easily. You can stagger breaks. In busier facilities, what plants have done is that they have tried to do break shifts up, shorten shifts, stagger shifts, make people work in groups, take break in groups, so that if there is an index case, it's more confined, it's more limited. Some food facilities simply cannot exercise the social distancing to 6 feet. Like a boning line in a poultry plant or a meat plant, it's just not set up that way and to continue to be operationally efficient. So in those instances, there's been suggestions of, okay, does a plexiglass shield between people help? Yeah, it probably helps. It reduces transmission a little bit. Those are the sorts of instances where moving to properly fitted use of face masks and training around them
is starting to be more widely implemented. So I think that there is all that component of trying to reduce the risk of spread, and then with a heavy focus on wellness checks. And what I mean by that is checking multiple times in a day, potentially. You know, do you have a fever? Do you have a cough? Do you have shortness of breath? And when people show up, have you had any contact with a COVID diagnosed person, either with a test or with a clinical diagnosis, and excluding them? So all of these different strategies are in place, and some work more effectively than others in different manufacturing facilities. So, but those are some of the principles I've seen used, and with good effect.
Bruce, what have you seen with some of the manufacturers that you've worked with?
Yeah, and I'd agree with David. A lot of things that David talked about, I've seen as well. Again, build on that. I've seen manufacturers that have opened up all of their meeting rooms as lunch rooms, including the boardroom, so that you can get the social distancing during a lunch break. I've seen split breaks, split shifts. One of my clients is running at reduced speed at the moment with an attempt to put fewer people on the line, and therefore they're running a little slower. Virtually everybody is excluding non-essential visitors, which is makes it interesting to define what essential and non-essential is. You've got to be clear that some visitors are essential, like you don't really want to stop all of your pest control activities. And more often than not, most people are using external pest control facilities. So you don't really want to stop all of that. And really, at work, people are scared. We know that. And so I'm seeing a lot of people that are putting a lot more effort into making sure that they communicate well and compassionately around this, so that we can ease the tension for people.
Right. Well, I think you're calling out some of those good, you know, minute details, right? This is so disruptive that you have to think through who can or cannot come on your campus, especially the contractors that help keep you running. I mean, I can't imagine having to make some of these plans that these facilities are having to do. So I am interested in diving a little bit deeper into something. I believe, David, you mentioned this earlier, that some of the food safety programs are kind of stretched logistically by some of these new guidelines that are put in place. I'm curious as to how are food manufacturers taking that into consideration to ensure food safety given these new workplace guidelines? So, David, I'll start with you, and Bruce will have you weigh in as well.
No, thanks. I think if we look at that, we're seeing impacts on the systems that go actually beyond manufacturing. One of the concerns that I've got, and I will see it more perhaps going forward, is if you go right back to growers, harvesting produce is a pretty labor-intensive operation. And you know, in many instances, you're working very close together. I mean, if any of the people listening to this have ever been to a field of romaine lettuce being harvested, there's a crew in there, and they're right next to each other. 6-foot social distancing might work, but it would create some logistic challenges, and the equipment's not set up for that. So, some of those food safety challenges will get into managing that. Can you split people up? We'll have crews that get sick and can't show up. We've obviously got much of the, depending where you are in the country, many of those harvesting crews are individuals who come up from south of the border to work as temporary workers, licensed nevertheless, or legal. I'm not saying they're not legal, but we rely very heavily, and that people movement has got restricted. So I can see some impacts beginning there. You know, you keep going up the supply chain. We've got in the manufacturing facilities, as people get sick, there will be stresses and strains on lines. There'll be less people perhaps working a line. You know, often one of the first things that a company will slide on a little bit is, well, we perhaps don't need to do the preventive maintenance quite as often because it's preventive. You know, maybe we could let the cleaning and sanitation slip just a little bit. Well, clearly letting that slip is a really bad idea with this virus. But, you know, it's human nature. What can we, you know, it's like job number one, get the food out the door. Well, yeah, but you got to do it with safely and obviously with appropriate quality. So what's not critical in our company? Well, the preventive maintenance might, as I say, might slip. Maybe we don't need to check the metal detector every hour. We could check it every other hour and have the QA person on the line. And I've heard that. Not that specific thing, but it's like, well, the QA people are all filling in the gaps on the lines. They're not doing their QA thing as much as they were. That's where we'll see some problems. That's where we'll start to see slippage as the push to continue to supply the food pressures the system. And I've already mentioned bringing on temporary employees, which is always a risky business to begin with, depending on what they're doing. They've got to be trained. They've got to know what they're doing. So this is going to stress the systems quite a bit. And I don't think we're really ready for it, because it's not like in food manufacturing. There's a lot of fat. Food plants run pretty lean. They don't have big margins. And obviously, this outbreak isn't pushing up the food prices. That would be a problem. We've seen the prices of other things go up, but not food. At least not as far as I know. So we'll start to see those factors weighing in. And I'm particularly worried, Matt, over the next 6 weeks, as the number of illnesses goes up, which it will, and the impact across all sectors goes up, this is going to get more and more and more challenging. And we will have to just watch it and provide the support and help to the companies as we go forward.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the picture that's being painted is one that, you know, this is something that we haven't seen before. And it, like you said, it really is going to be, it's going to stretch a lot of these manufacturing environments to kind of to the edge, because they do operate so lean. Bruce, what are your thoughts here?
Again, I'll try and build on what David said and not repeat what he said, because I do agree with his comments. He's absolutely right on point. One of the things that we will see is disruption in the supply chain. So there will be times when you will not be able to get the raw material that you want to buy, do normally buy, for whatever reason, that it was being produced in a plant in China and they happened to stop manufacturing for a period of time. It got held up at a port, or that particular plant is shut down for some reason. So there will be disruptions in the food supply. And at that point, you're looking for an alternative raw material. And generally, you'll be looking for that raw material in a situation where you will not be able to do your normal due diligence around that supplier. So you'll be using that raw material, or wanting to use that raw material, in the absence of some of the normal checks and balances that you might normally put in place. Once you start down that path and you start to compromise your systems with respect to what your controls are, does that open up the floodgates? And I think it's incumbent upon all of us within the food industry to make sure that we have the discipline to do the things that are essential to ensure that food safety is never compromised. Some of that is communication. You know, the upside to this is that what I'm seeing is hand wash discipline has never been better in the plants that I visit. It's quite interesting that, you know, for years and years and years, we've really struggled to try and get compliance to personal hygiene, and suddenly we've got it. Never waste a good crisis. When we see a drop in poisoning cases, I suspect that we will. That will be kind of interesting. But what will be the residual impact of that is what interests me. And how can we ensure there is a sustained benefit to that change that we're seeing in people's behaviours? So the downside risk, of course, is that people will neglect the basics, as I've said. And really, that will become even more so, as David said, when you start to see that the workforce starts to deplete due to illness. And again, that comes back to communication. It's really important for all the food manufacturers to put very robust, detailed plans in place as to what they will do in their plant when they get the first case, because they will get a first case, and what they will do in their plant when they get a second case, and what they will do in their plant when they get a third case, and make sure they build into that what the communication plan is with their staff to make sure their staff are prepared to keep coming back despite the fact they've had multiple cases. Communication is going to be absolutely critical in order for us to get through this crisis in a way that maintains the capability of our food systems.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what I'm hearing from both of you is kind of like almost a call to the manufacturers in the food industry is, you know, keep workers healthy as much as you can. Make sure you have appropriate planning in place so that when something does happen, you can quickly get people up to speed or what have you in order to maintain production. But also really first and foremost is to keep food safety front of mind, because like David said earlier, this would be very bad timing to have any sort of food safety crisis on top of an already difficult situation.
Yeah, you know, if I could, you're right, Matt, and if I could just add something to what Bruce said, that food workers are no different from any other individual in our society who is looking at what's going on. So well, food safety, it's obviously the focus of all of us professionally. It's what we do. And that's critically important. We mustn't lose sight of the fact that every food worker is fearful for their own health and well-being. They're fearful for their family's well-being. They're, I'm sure, are worried about economics, personal economics. You know, they're worried about transportation. They may well be worried about an elderly relative. They're thinking, well, you know, if I just hunker down at home, I'll be safe, as opposed to why should I risk traveling from home to work on a bus or on a metro or in a carpool or whatever, however they're doing it. So I it goes back to the communication word that Bruce used. We have to, as food safety professionals and those who work in the food industry, we have to recognize that while food safety is absolutely critical, all of us, and we can all identify with this, are worried about this at many different levels. And if you're not managing all of those anxieties for your employees, you're going to antagonize them. They're going to get upset. They're going to obviously self-preserve. They won't have their mind on food safety, and we'll wind up in a bigger pickle than we're in. So I think it's really important to keep in mind that people coming to work are doing a really important job, and they're going through a million stresses and strains, and yet still showing up and making food and doing it safely. So it's part of the package. It's part of acknowledging that they are actually sacrificing. I know the focus is on health workers, and appropriately so. But we've got a lot of people in our infrastructure who are keeping America going, and our food worker colleagues are part of that.
Absolutely. I think that is just a fantastic point. And I mean, I totally agree. These people are keeping us going. We need to continue to have a food supply, and there's some interesting demand on the food supply right now. And these people are the bedrock of that industry. So I do want to go a little bit further in how food manufacturers can address the issue of food safety during this time. So obviously, you both made the great point that communication is key in this. But, you know, does there need to be consistency among food manufacturers and how they continue to address food safety throughout this pandemic? And are there multiple correct approaches to ensure food safety throughout this? Bruce, let's go with you first.
Yeah, I think there's such a diversity of different processes that it's hard to generalize on food safety specifically. But I think we can generalize around the people hygiene aspects of food safety. And absolutely, there are basics that we all know and we've all talked about and you've all heard other people talk about already. Social distancing, of course, we all know about social distancing, hand washing, don't touch your face, report illnesses. They're all good advice, even without a pandemic. So continuing to reinforce those, I think, is absolutely critical. And I think it goes beyond that. I mean, under the pandemic situation, you're now at a point where I think we need to say to people that even if you are living with somebody that is ill, then you should consider also staying away from work, because the chances that you may become also infected and be asymptomatic and spread it in the workplace is rather large. So I think the reporting of your own personal illness becomes critical, and reporting of illnesses around you and people you've come in contact with is something that, unfortunately, we're going to have to ask everybody to do. So I think it's less about food safety processes and more about the basics of hygiene is where I would go.
Right. And I think that makes sense, because, you know, the fewer people that are going to be out of work due to illness and things like that will keep some greater consistency in some of these environments. David, what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, I think what Bruce is saying is right on target. It sort of goes back to some of the earlier points, I think, Matt, that where the fundamental food safety programs are what they are, and they're built on science, and they're built on good behaviors and putting those good behaviors and good science into practice. Fundamentally, none of that should change. I think we, you know, a big theme of this conversation is that we recognize that that's the fundamentals. But the pandemic is stressing that system. It's stressing people. It's stressing the system. It's stressing it at every level. And continuing to put emphasis on that is going to be important. So long as we keep that in mind and are being consistent across our enterprise, but recognize that we may have to make adjustments. We may have to make changes in staffing, in running a line. We may have to slow things down. We may have to do things differently. And there's already, I think Bruce mentioned, there's going to be supply chain disruption. And we may have to reformulate based on some lack of availability of an ingredient. We're not well set up to do that quickly. Anyway, I mean, reformulation and doing it safely is not something that can be done fast. And yet here we are, we got to do it fast if we're going to continue to make food. So there's so many different parameters here that we have to keep in mind. And, you know, based on dozens of conversations every day with food companies, literally across the world, the leadership in these food companies is entirely focused on COVID-19. They're letting the system run itself on the food safety side. And, you know, like any system, it'll run for a while, but as soon as you take your eyes off it, stuff will go wrong. And we're in the early phases of this. And you know, this is an oft-used comment, but we're not in a sprint. This is truly a marathon. And if we don't pace ourselves and balance ourselves and hydrate and get our calories in as we go, at mile 18, we're going to trip up and have a crash. So we have got to keep that in mind. And it's so easy for us food safety gurus to say, oh, food safety is so important. But man, if we don't recognize all these other pressures, then all we're doing is just preaching without actually providing assistance and support and recognition and help to try to, you know, how do we do these things safely? How do we do these things expeditiously? How can we maintain the safety of the products and at the same time balance all of these other factors of the stresses and the strains and the reduced workforce and the shifted production lines? It is a very heavy lift. And I think at the moment we're sort of taking it for granted that our well-oiled machine will continue to be well-oiled. Well, you know, we know what happens. If you're not watching those things, things go wrong. And that's what we've got to safeguard against.
Well, and I do want to, you know, in the last couple moments here, I do want to kind of take some time to think about, you know, what manufacturers can expect to see in the future in that respect. So, you know, I want to break it down in a little bit to the immediate future, but then also, you know, greater than 6 months out, maybe. So focusing on the next, you know, two to six months, which is quite a range, given how fast a lot of this is evolving, what do we think manufacturers can expect to see? David, I'll start with you.
Well, we're already seeing it, Matt. Absenteeism, part of it because people are sick, part of it because they're scared, they don't want to come to work. So we'll see impact on workforce. We will absolutely see impact on supply chain. I hope we don't run out of critical consumables like cleaning agents and sanitizing systems and swabs and all of the things that we need to do on a routine basis. But all of those systems are under pressure. And, you know, if you go out 2 months, the absenteeism, the use of temporary workers, the having to shift lines, alter work schedules, that's happening already. That is a fact today. As we go out more towards your 6 month trajectory, I think we're going to see the cases, at least in North America, they're going to peak well within that. They're going to flatten off, and then within 6 months, I have every confidence they'll be well on their way down, if not low by 6 months from now. But in that interim, we're going to see some huge supply chain stress. We're going to see people just getting worn out. This is tiring. We're asking people to do a lot. You know, it's not like you can go out for dinner and a beer on Friday evening to unwind and relax. Nope, you can't do that. Bars are closed, restaurants are closed. You know, if you run into the beer store, it's like socially distance, wear your mask, do whatever you're going to do. You know, don't talk to anybody. I mean, we're having to turn into sort of little animals living in holes and not socially interact. And, you know, humans are not built that way. So I think, again, you know, I know I'm going a bit beyond food safety, but these are the pressures that are going to start to weigh on us. And, you know, like I say, we've got to get our mind around this is a marathon. We're in this for months, and we've got to adjust, and we've got to accept it. We've got to support each other. You know, we've got to be kind to each other. Don't add more stress to the system than is already there because of this very unpleasant outbreak that's going on. So I'm all over the map on the answer to that question, but I think there's many, 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 many things that we need to be thinking about.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great message. Bruce, what are your thoughts about the next, you know, six or so months of this?
I think the whole situation that we're in at the moment will start wearing thin on most people. Maintaining the discipline around the things we've been talking about, the social distancing, the hand washing, the making sure that you're not touching your face, making sure that you report all illnesses and maintaining that is going to be extremely difficult to maintain the rage, if you like. So how we do that is going to be quite interesting. I think we might need to refresh the message somehow because the message is already old. And it's going to continue to get older. I think the other thing that where my mind goes is what does the new normal really look like, and will customers come back quickly or not, or are we resetting the model of what consumer behavior is going to be like? I mean, we've seen the dramatic decline of food service sales and the offsetting dramatic increase in retail grocery sales. Does that mean that consumers have suddenly found a new love for being at home and cooking at home, and they take time to reset what food service is all about? We're hearing numbers from the food service industry that There is already at least 3% of restaurants that are closed permanently, never to reopen, even after the pandemic is gone. And some forecasts by some pundits that that number could go as high as 30%. And I think about what the industry will look like with 30% less restaurants in it, and that's a very different world from what we've been used to. So I think how we go about adjusting to whatever the new normal is going to be quite interesting.
Absolutely. And going beyond, 6 months, I think you've both touched on the fact that this will in some way have some sort of lasting effects on the food industry and on the global food system. And I'm curious, when we think about these long-term effects and maybe how companies have addressed the fact that their food safety fundamentals have been stressed, what do we see as some of those lasting changes in how companies kind of go about, making food and ensuring that it's safe? Bruce, I'll start with you.
I think we will now see is as part of everybody's SOPs, the SOPs around how to manage in a pandemic, whereas that got lip service in the past. There were a lot of people saying that we are overdue for a pandemic because we haven't had one for quite a number of decades. And as a result, there were very few businesses that really had crisis management plans in place for something of this nature, and they've been hastily written. So I think in future we'll see a lot more crisis preparedness activity going on than we've seen in the past. My experience has been in the jobs and businesses I've worked with is the businesses that are best prepared for a crisis are those that have been through one. And businesses that have never been through one, a leadership team or a management team that's never been through a crisis, generally is relatively unprepared and generally doesn't appreciate the nuance of maintaining and practicing and doing trial runs and making sure that the systems and processes are in place just in case there is a crisis. Now that we've all been through one, I think that's going to change and we will be a lot more prepared in the future. But I suspect that the next pandemic is so far off that that will all have fallen by the wayside by the time it comes around. So it will be really interesting to see what happens.
David, what are your thoughts on these lasting effects?
Well, I think that one of the things that we'll learn in this, and it gets back to the theme of what we've been talking about, is there anything we can do more efficiently? There's nothing like a crisis to drive you to do things more efficiently and figure out what you really need and what you don't need. It gets you to trim the fat off the systems. And as we've said, there's not a lot of fat in most food safety systems. But the one area where we might see change is the use of technology. This is something that I think the food industry as a whole lags behind on is food production is very data rich, and it looking at ways to better leverage data to control risks is an opportunity here. We are a little bit stuck on our clipboards and writing down numbers, and at best we might upgrade to an Excel spreadsheet, but it's very labor intensive. And as we're sort of running out of people and we still have to control all those risks, then what's an alternative? Well, let's spend a little money and hook these machines up to automatic data technology. Let's hook it up to state-of-the-art quality management systems. Let's have the technology and the smart people behind SaaS solutions to start to leverage that more than it is. And that's often an answer when the humans get a little thin and stressed is to revert to technology. One could extend that to automation of lines and other things like that, but that takes a while to implement. I think some of this information technology could come online pretty quick because it's there already. It's just not really being implemented very much. So that may be a long-lasting legacy where we actually finally the food industry leaps into the technology era and with both feet, because it's, you know, it's been a little bit of dabbling and exploration and stuff, but I don't know whether that'll happen. It's just sort of gazing into the crystal ball and thinking, you know, what could one see coming out of this that could both help food safety and leverage systems, and in the longer term actually be a cost-effective solution. So that's just a thought, and it's an opportunity to explore that a bit more.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a good, you know, kind of positive outlook of, you know, what this could kind of push the food industry to progress into. And I think that, you know, if there's anything to come out of this and that's positive, it could be something like that. Well, I want to thank you both for your time and your insights. And also, I'd like to thank our listeners. If you're enjoying Food Disruptors, please let us know by leaving a review on iTunes or by connecting with IFT. You can find us at IFT on Twitter and by searching the Institute of Food Technologists on Facebook and LinkedIn. For more information on how COVID-19 is affecting the global food system, check out the IFT homepage on ift.org. It has a link to IFT's novel coronavirus updates. Thanks all for listening to Food Disruptors. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden. Have a great day, everyone.